Welcome back, friends, to the Eye Opener Report here on BoilingFrogsPost.com. I'm your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and today we have a very special treat lined up for you, a conversation about this book, which you might remember I reviewed quite recently on the Corbett Report. It is The Lone Gladio by Sibel Edmonds, a new spy thriller and a completely fictional novel about the very real Gladio B. And for people, who don't know about Operation Gladio B and the real history behind it, I would highly suggest you check out our five-part video interview series that we conducted with Sibel Edmonds last year that hasn't got nearly enough views, I think, for the bombshell explosive material that is contained therein. But hopefully this novel will go at least some of the way towards correcting that and getting more people aware of this extremely, extremely important part of the geopolitical puzzle that is taking place in the world today. Sibel Edmonds, BoilingFrogsPost.com editor and founder, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you. And thank you for the invite, James, as always.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I am extremely excited to talk about this novel for many different reasons. And I'm actually going to start this conversation perhaps in a different place than most of these conversations start. Most of them end on this note, but I want to start on it because I think it's an important part of what this book is and what it represents. And we can take this from a post that you put up on BoilingFrogsPost.com. Self-publishing, a powerful tool to challenge the corporate establishment and the deep state. And this is extremely important because, of course, this is a self-published novel. You did not go to Random House or any of those other big mega corporation publishers to get this published, for many reasons, I suppose, and we can get into some of those reasons, but I want to highlight this because, of course, as an aspiring writer once myself, it was always the death mark of any literary career. Oh, you never self-publish. Oh, that would just be how could you possibly do that? You have to be part of the system. Which is, of course, complete bunkum, and we have moved into a new era in which this is not only possible and feasible, but is being done and can be done relatively easily. So let's talk about the process of how this book was created and how you stepped outside that corporate publishing system.
Sure. The idea of self-publishing actually was conceived during my first book, Classified Woman. For that book, I did that mistake. I went to those top five publishers and submitted my manuscript, which is basically, you submit it, they look at it, they're interested, they come and bid on it. And if, as you know, and I don't know if our viewers, all of them are familiar with that book or not, that book was basically blacked out by the FBI and Justice Department. I had submitted the book for pre-publication review to the FBI and DOJ because I had clearance. And if it's a non-fiction book, you have to do that. It's one of the ways they hook people with those security clearance business. And they had 2 months to review it and black out anything that they perceived to be classified, sensitive. So, and after 2 months, give it back to me. So I would take out those blackout areas and just publish the book. Well, they sat on it for 1 year and they blacked out everything. I had to get an attorney. They told my attorney that every single word in the book be considered classified. So we are not releasing a single word, which is ludicrous. And at that point, I had to make a decision. Do I just, shiver and go away? Or do I dare? And because I had a strong standing. I didn't put anything really classified, justifiably classified in the book. So I said, I'm going to publish it and have the government argue in court, tell the American people, how can a book, everything in a book, every single word be classified? I took the manuscript to the publishers and the top three, what they said was they needed to see the FBI and the Justice Department's, the review result saying that I'm allowed to publish this. I said, well, I don't have it. I'm daring them. And they said, well, count us out unless you bring us an explicit letter from the Justice Department saying that you can't publish. We are not going to do that. We're going to get into trouble. A couple of publishers actually went a little bit less than that in terms of being ridiculous. And they said, this book is great, but then your last few chapters deal with the Obama administration. And why don't you just end it on chapter 18 or 19 and not have those three chapters? Then it's a good book. So because this was during the Obama administration. And I said, this is a nonfiction and I'm not going to fictionalize it. It is the story and I'm not going to chop the story based on what you're saying. I decided, okay, I'm going to self-publish it. And as you just mentioned, James, so much stigma gets to be attached to self-publishers because a lot of people are like, oh, if it's self-published, the quality is not going to be there and it's going to be like book. Because to produce a book, really, you have a lot of ingredients go into it. You sit down and write it. Okay, fine. That's only the first step. You have to have it really nicely edited by someone objective, not yourself. You have to have the interior design. You have to have the cover design. You have to have proofreaders, and you work with them, and you do proofreading too. It's a pretty tedious process, and it's costly. But to do it right, I said, I want to do it right. My husband and I, we went and we took out a loan, a small loan, and I established a team, and I was very fortunate. I really ended up with a great team, some wonderful people. My editor, he used to be with HarperCollins for, I don't know, 25, 30 years, senior editor, and he had retired or left the company, so he came on board. Same thing, I got an award winner for a cover design, and with prices that were not outrageous, you know, it was reasonable. And it took us 6 months to 9 months to produce this book, going through all the editing several times, etc. I wanted for it to be everything that a good book coming out of a professional publishing house would have in terms of ingredients. And for that, you have to do the work and you have to get the talents. And I believe it was successful for a self-published book. I sold close to 25,000 copies. Without any marketing, I didn't get any reviews in Washington Post or New York Times or LA Times or NPR or any of those networks, etc. So through the word of mouth and hopefully because the quality was there, people got the book. And for me, the most important reviews came from people who actually posted at, you know, sites like Amazon. And that's, for me, is much more valuable than, let's say, New York Times review with their own bias and propaganda, whatever it is. And it was heartwarming to receive that. So for this book, for The Lone Gladio, I didn't have to go through the whole rounds of going to the publishers. I said, I'm going to write this book and I'm going to do exactly the same thing. I'm going to self-publish it with a great team and took the time, again, working with them and putting it out there. But also, as a principle, it's not only about editorial freedom in terms of nobody really censoring you, but it's also about what we have been preaching here at Boiling Frogs Post and through Corbett Report, and that is we can do a lot of things collectively, and they are very effective, but there are so many things we can do individually. It may seem as nothing, one step, one individual, but if you add those up, it can be tremendous. And that is, we are saying, you know, damn the big corporations and the publishing houses with their ties to the government. Well, if we say that and then go and publish our books through them, I mean, that would be truly a hypocrisy. It's like exercise then say, this is my chance. This is one step I'm going to take in addition to all the other steps I'm taking, you know, collectively, the stuff we are doing together, and say, I'm going to challenge, I'm going to bypass, I'm going to make the publishing houses irrelevant. And today, with the internet, with all the things that we have in place, it's doable, so why not? And as from what I see, so many authors, good authors, are doing it, and they're actually making these big publishing houses irrelevant. If you look at their track records and their stock prices, you will see that they've been shrinking and they've been miserable. We have had many buyouts. Now you have like maybe two that owns basically all of them, including the medium-sized ones. And it's not there. It's not there for them. Thanks to all these people who say, it can be done. And we don't need to rely upon some big publishing houses. We can do all the stuff in-house ourselves and take a stand and say, here is one way. You know, it's very similar to people who decide to homeschool. And say, we can complain about it, but if enough people, I mean, today, 3-4 million people are homeschooling, that is not an insignificant number. I mean, but it all starts with each one individual family saying, I'm going to homeschool. I'm not going to outsource my kid to the big, you know, to the big brother, to the government. I'm going to do it myself. Well, as a result, they are panicking. they are panicking. Department of Social Services are going and knocking on the door of these people. Are you vaccinating your kids? They're trying to tie it to some sort of child abuse. And even with where I live, they have started countering it, saying, okay, how about if you don't homeschool, but take all the stuff online and come to school for testing? Because they know people are looking at the options of either homeschooling or not homeschooling, sending their kids. They're trying to do something that is still theirs, which is the government intended stuff. And so, yes, it's being effective and it's in millions. And the self-publishing is exactly the same kind of example. That was a long answer again.
but a very important one. And again, I think that if nothing else comes from this novel, if only the idea of self-publishing and getting around the corporate system that's been set up to basically control what we see and hear, if people get that message, if nothing else, I think this will have been a success. And I mean, we just have to reflect on the fact that we are in an incredible age. The mainstream news broadcast networks are dying on the vine. The music industry, the big record labels are bleeding customers. You have the publishing industry, as you say, suffering. And again, these are all outdated models for distribution that were maybe necessary at some point in our history, but are not necessary in this internet age. So I'm glad that more people are stepping up to the plate and putting their money where their mouth is on this extremely important issue. And I agree completely. It's about what we can do as individuals to actually live the ideals and the principles that we're talking about rather than just complaining about them. So my hat's off to you for doing this. And the for people who do think, oh, self-publishing must mean poor quality, of course that has not borne out in the reviews of this book. And of course people who have watched my review already know that I extremely thoroughly enjoyed this book. But don't just take my word for it. I mean, go to Amazon or go to Boiling Frog's post, look at some of the reviews and comments and things that people have left, a slew of five-star reviews with titles like Incredible Book, A Page-Turning Thriller, or Brilliantly Sophisticated, Unreasonably Excellent. I thought that was a particularly good title. So obviously people are quite happy with the way that this book turned out. And I think that this perhaps is best encapsulated by Sean Grady, who left a comment on that post about self-publishing on Boiling Frog's post, where he said, "I bought The Lone Gladio. I was hoping it would at least be interesting enough for me to get through it and get more needed information. Instead, I couldn't put it down. I read it in just over a day, going late into the night. You could fairly say I devoured it. I immediately bought Sibel's other book, A Classified Woman, and devoured it as well. Thank you so much for your courage and your willingness to take this journey." And I think that's pretty representative of the reviews that I've read online. People saying that it's a page-turner, they couldn't put it down. That was certainly my experience of the novel. Let's talk a little bit about the process of making something that could be a dry lecture on geopolitics into an extremely engaging thriller. Yeah, how did you write that and turn it into fiction?
Well, again, that started with my first book, with Classified Woman, because that was when I actually found that as I was going through the process of pre-pub review, that was when I found out that you don't have to do anything with the government if it's a fiction. And actually, I was even thinking, saying just throughout the whole thing, if I can't publish it, you know, even as self-published, I'm going to go ahead and write a fiction. So the idea was conceived around that time. And as soon as I finished the book, as soon as it came out, a few months later, I started jotting down bullet points, because the idea, the notion itself of me sitting and writing fiction, you know, I never considered myself an author. I used to consider myself an aspiring author when I was in Turkey. Turkish was my primary language. But a lot of stigma was attached when I came to the United States and English became my third language. And I went to the university and took all my courses with this fear that not only that I have to accomplish all these, you know, get the grades, et cetera, I have to do it in a language that is not my native language. So I always had that, I don't know, some people may call it complex, saying, okay, I can't write, you know. And if I sit down and start writing with that thought that I want to write everything so polished, you know, and so perfect, I won't be able to write even 10 pages. What worked for me and what works for me, I start with bullet points and jotting down ideas, you know, and they come to me. I know it's going to sound strange, but my best ideas usually come to me when I'm taking a shower. That is so weird. For some reason, and I like to take long showers, which have been quite luxury after becoming a mother, because my shower had been like rush, 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 take shower. But and then I sit down and write in the evening, because I really like to have quiet environment. Everyone gone. My husband is gone to, you know, to bed, and my daughter sleeps around 8:30, 9 o'clock. And I usually work till 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, but I write without taking any pauses. You know, I just let it go, you know, just let it out and write and write and not worry about all the structures and all the these. That was one of the biggest problems I had with English, you know, with the, because it's not one of those formulas that you can memorize and say, you know, the works here, the doesn't work here. I give you an example of this thing with, for example, God. I'm like, the God, you know, because you told me to my teacher, if it's singular and if it's one is specific, well, God, you guys are considering it a specific, so why isn't it the God? Anyhow, then once I'm done, I with this book, with the Long Gladio, I ended up about 600, 650 pages. So I'm sure, you know, and not that I'm sure, there were so many repetitive things, etc., or things that made it way too complicated. Then I'll take my second round. This is when I try to eliminate things, expand upon certain things. Then I go through the third round. And then after the third round, I consider it good enough to go to my editor for all the or you know, it's for example, in one page I had several times, 3 or 4 times, you know, he sighed. It's like, okay, one sigh is enough per page, and you don't want sigh. I mean, but when you're writing, you don't want to get tied up, especially if you're writing about imaginative stuff, and you don't want to. So that was the process, and it took about a year and a half, 2 years to bring it to a point where it went over to my editor. And then it was another 8 to 9 months after that to complete it and put it out there. And it was a very interesting process. I would say one of the most interesting experiences I've had. I'm sure every author has different kind of experience when they write fiction, and especially if you're writing spy thriller. But with me, I felt like for almost a year and a half, I was walking in the clouds. I couldn't really be present in presence. I mean, the things were going inside my head and the scenes and the feelings associated with certain things. And you really get into it. And I don't know, some people who write, I don't know, they write one book a year, after a while it becomes cookie cutter formula. That may be a different process for them. But for me, it was amazing how much it consumed me. It consumed everything I had. And it was exhausting. I mean, emotionally, it was really exhausting. I had some, you know, elevated high moments when I got rid of some really bad people. It felt good. Maybe there will be some bunch of psychological theories attached to it, you know. The way for a person to get rid of the excessive anger, all the things that have been accumulated for the years. Well, whatever the reason, it was amazing. It was tremendous. And my husband was truly shocked when I finished and let him read it for the first time. I didn't let him read anything until I was done for my first round. And he was taken, not because it was, you know, he said it was great or something. He said, how could you think of these things? And then I also let other people, you know, look at the second edited draft and give me feedback. And the reaction was, it doesn't feel like a woman wrote this. You know, this is a book that seems to be written by man for man. And I don't view it as such. I don't know why that's the case. My own reading, I mean, a lot of people have likened this book to Ludlum's. I have never read any of Ludlum's book, and I have never watched any of the movies. I have seen some clips on one of these Bourne characters. It's not my kind of movie, and I don't believe those are my kind of books. But the amazing thing was how many people came and said, my God, this was a new Bourne, and this is so Ludlum-esque. And I'm thinking, I haven't even read Ludlum. But The only time I call it, I read, I don't want to call it trash work, but I read those kinds of books. I usually am into more classical books, but I do it in the airport because when I'm on the plane, I'm really not in the mood to open a nonfiction book and get into this. I want kind of a trashy kind of books. And the process for me, the reading it is, you know, I read it like in 2 hours, 350 pages, because so much fillers, I call them fillers, go into the book, you know, I and it gets on my nerve. It's like 4 pages of the sun rays going through the trees and then one of the shooting star passes that I can't write like that. And if I'm reading action thriller, I don't care what the sun was doing. You know, it's fine if it's during the sunset time. Okay. But don't give me all the fillers. I go like 2 pages read and then go 6 pages and then I read 2 pages. Or the love scenes, you know, he moaned and then she moaned and then he grunted and he grunted again. I'm like, go, fast. I was like, my husband goes, yeah, you read that in 2 hours. I'm like, yeah, filler. Okay, beginning, the end, fine. We are done with that. So you don't get that in this book because, I don't know, maybe some people look for those things in the books. Maybe that is what they consider intimate details. But I had a mission, okay? I had a story, and I had my characters, and I wanted to get through all the important things and the scenes, and I really didn't have the space or the time to put a lot of gruntings and moanings in my book. And
there was a little, to be fair, there was a little bit of that lovey-dovey stuff.
It was only once, and it was like, checkmark over, fine, they did it. Now let's move on. Right.
Yeah. Well, but it's so interesting to hear about that process, because that makes sense to me that you wrote a lot more than ended up going in the book, because I think the complexity is still there. There is still a lot of different little plots going on that you might not understand at first until they start to weave together. So you have to keep reading to sort of connect those dots, which I think is part of the page-turning appeal of it. And there's a complexity there, but I think there is a narrative through thread, because there are certain elements to this story that I think people connect with, people recognize from other stories. The idea of the kind of special forces agent who goes rogue against the agency that turned against him, and that kind of, those ideas, those tropes, I think, are things that people can relate to from other stories that they've seen before, and that helps, I think, pull the narrative along. So from a narrative perspective, I thought it was extremely well done, and this is a book that bears rereading because of that complexity and because of the different elements that I think you might miss the first time through. So I think that all works in favor of this. I guess that, well, I mean, we can talk about that perhaps at the end, but I understand this might be part of a trilogy or a subsequent series of books, which I certainly hope so. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about the narrative itself, I suppose. And again, I don't want to get into plot synopsis per se, but of course we do have not only the rogue Gladio agent, OG-58? I'm suddenly blanking. I believe 58. And of course, Sibella, I mean, Elsie Simon, who is the plucky FBI agent who ends up working with him reluctantly, perhaps. And there is, I wouldn't even say moral ambiguity. I would say that there are downright immoral things that are perpetrated by the protagonists, or at least the anti-heroes of this story. It's certainly not a straightforward story in terms of the good guys versus the bad guys, because I think this book excellently conveys the idea that when it comes to this shadowy world of intelligence work, there are no clean hands. Everyone who puts their hands into it gets their hands bloody in some way. Let's talk a little bit about that aspect of this. I think this must have been one of the driving points of the narrative, is that there really is this very murky world that's going on that most people have absolutely no idea about, and that really is driving world geopolitics. How do you even begin to put this into a story form?
Well, a lot of it came with experiences, and through my organization, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, the coalition that we formed with, in reality, over 145, 150 national security whistleblowers. Some of these people have never become really public. So I worked with and I established relationship, friendships with many people from the CIA, from the DIA, from the FBI, from the DEA. And I got to know their stories and their cases inside and out, but also I got to know them as persons, each one of them as his or her own person. And what led them, let's say, to work for the CIA? How was the hiring process? You know, what did they do? How did they feel implementing or conducting certain operations that involved some really gruesome stuff? Did they really separate themselves, you know, from the operations and what they were doing, you know, stepping, you know, outside body experience, or did they enjoy it? You know, when we're looking at some of the more gruesome tortures, which are very, very real. And I started seeing the patterns, for example, with the FBI, not that we like the FBI or anything, with when you deal with the FBI agents, you look at more like the law enforcement, sheriff kind of mentality. You know, they always wanted to be an FBI agent or a sheriff because they wanted to go and catch the bad guys. And a pretty linear stories in terms of how they ended up working for the FBI, for the agents at least. But the CIA, you get a totally, totally, totally different picture. And I'm not talking about the analysts for the CIA. I'm talking about operatives. And I got to know some characters, some people, you know, who were DIA, some of them crossover DIA and the CIA, and how they ended up with the agencies, what were the qualifications that led them to be hired. And a very frightening pattern emerged. And I know if we have some ex-CIA people or CIA people watching this or the whistleblowers, they're going to hate me for saying that. But one of the realities that I got to see or the patterns was that a lot of these people were grew up in under some really horrible or difficult circumstances, and with some really hard childhood, and more than three or four cases, I was told, and it's amazing, even down to the sentence being right, that had I not been accepted by the army or this and then ended up in the CIA, I would have been either a serial killer or a big time crook. I would have ended up in jail because the agency allowed me to do a lot of things for my country. So I was not doing it as illegal, raping or torturing or hurting people. I was putting them in use, those tendencies, those psychological tendencies that I have, into some good work. So they also justified that in the end, it's good work. To me, that was amazing. And also for interviewers, people who do the selection in the CIA, again, not for the analysts, not for the language specialists, but for operatives, what kind of qualifications they look for. They look for people who are very good liars. You know, they can beat the polygraph. They can, you know, poker face lying, pathological liars, okay? People who don't have really strong sense of conscience, people who don't get bothered, like they do it. You have some of it with the military, but not the same way the CIA expects. So a lot of those came from real life experiences, and the situations came from firsthand experiences. Whether you're dealing with the Congress, corruption, whether you're dealing with the maybe triple monitoring, which kinds of, you know, I think it's kind of funny when you have someone who's being followed by someone and then someone else is following that person. And it really is so real life. It is not, oh my God, it was so exaggerated. It's very real life in terms of monitoring and collecting real dirt on key people, whether they're in Congress or they have, you know, they are within the executive branch. That happens, has been happening on a daily basis. That was happening even before 9/11. All the key people in key positions in the Congress are monitored, and the dirt is, you know, are always collected on them. Not by the FBI, at least it was not the case. It was by the CIA. And anyhow, so those were again real experiences. But one funny thing, not funny, but interesting aspect of it was, you just mentioned Elsie Simon, 5'3", this pesky little translator, analyst. While I was writing this book, you would think that I would mostly identify with her, because even though she didn't become exactly a whistleblower, you know, her experience in the FBI, etc., I could not identify. I kept distancing myself. I was writing her scenes and in, I don't want to say robotic, because I went through those experiences, but the person that I really got into, I don't want to say I became, that would be really, truly scary, was Greg McPherson. And here was something really strange for me. You would think I would identify, this is my character I'm writing. No. I'm a lot of the feelings and associations, everything came with what I had with Greg. And to me, that was really peculiar, maybe to a certain degree frightening. And I spoke with my editor and I said, you know, I had this experience and how odd is this? And he said, it happens sometimes that some people, especially if they're feeling really strongly or if they have gone through some traumas that they are relating, they distance themselves from the person who's the most like themselves. And they actually bond and become one with the person who's least like them. Well, it really took place with writing this book. And again, that itself was that was really amazing. And I'm sure there are other psychological theories explaining that. But
well, I mean, but it's again, it's fascinating to hear that, because as Elsie starts to form some sort of bond or uneasy alliance with Greg, so too does perhaps Sibel form some sort of bond or uneasy alliance with Greg. But again, that brings with it moral complications that I don't think we want to go into, but it does raise the point, which I think is the central point for probably most of the viewers of this interview about this book, which is that clearly this is a book that is based on very real information, and yet of course it is a work of fiction, and there are fictional licenses taken, but it's the skirting of that line and the interplay of that. And I think we all understand or should understand the reasons why you fictionalized this narrative and why you are still alive today to talk about it because of that process of fictionalization. I mean, this is extremely, extremely important information. But as a reader myself, who of course has conducted that Gladio B interview series with you, I am reading this with that translator in my head, trying to translate each name and each organization into what is the real world equivalent of this. So, for example, I mean, Elsie goes into the archives of the FBI Washington field office and discovers the June 18th, 1998 memo documenting the meeting between the U.S. military attaché in Baku, Azerbaijan, with State Department officials, Pentagon, NATO officials, and Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of al-Hazar. And I don't know, I mean, it sounds a lot like Ayman al-Zawahiri, the right-hand man of Osama bin Laden, but man, that's of course just one step too forward. No, of course, this does relate to things that, again, we have discussed in the Gladio B series, quite obviously, but it always leaves me wondering how much of this can I interpret literally, that there is this file in the archives of the FBI Washington field office with these names just slightly altered. And it leaves, I guess it leaves me as a reader in an uneasy position, because at this point then, I, for example, I mean, let's go back to another example of this phenomenon where you had, I'm going to blank on his name now, E. Howard Hunt, who was a CIA operative and a fiction author, who became, of course, the fictional basis for Ethan Hunt of the Mission Impossible series and all of that. But he, at the end of his life, of course, recorded his deathbed confession where he confessed to taking part in what he called the big event to kill JFK, something that he had long been implicated in. And again, regardless of what you think of that confession in particular, one of the interesting things that he says in that is the reason that he never wrote about it or wrote a novel or fictionalized it in any way is because he didn't want to taint that event with fiction. He didn't want to cross that line. And yet here we are, we're taking these very real events that are going on even now today that are at the very heart of the geopolitical puzzle that is making up the world that we're living in and is affecting what's going on and the bombs that are dropping in Iraq and Syria and all of this craziness is being now fictionalized, and the readers are kind of interpreting and trying to find out, well, okay, which of this is fictionalized and which of it is absolute straight true reality. Does that put the reader in a difficult position with this? Does this actually taint the reality of this with fiction?
Well, no, several segmented answer for you here. One is the fact that that actually makes it more of a mystery because it is categorized, the book, as a mystery. And with some, I'm not going to say this is a good one, but with some good mysteries, some things are left to the reader's imagination and their own interpretation and their own take. The other thing is, I mean, if you look at books like, you know, 1984, you look like George Orwell, or if you look at Fahrenheit 451, yeah, they were fiction. But if you look at the philosophy behind these fictions, they were not real. They were fiction. And if you were to give that to, you know, 100 people, you would leave with 100 different maybe impressions or maybe 25 different categories of impressions. And again, that's another thing that goes into the, I believe, into the art of writing a book. And that is, I mean, if everything is so clear cut, you know, and linear and straightforward, then, you know, what do you have? And we have so many of those books out there. And then the other thing, of course, is, and again, that's a very difficult concept to be able to articulate and talk about, is that I believe, or I tried, or I really tried hard to achieve, to pack some important life philosophies or my own philosophies on issues that we have been exposed to. You know, I get to the issue of torture a lot in this book, and I don't provide any clear answer, you know, in terms of, you know, is right or wrong, but I am bringing or I'm trying to bring different perspectives of torture and how it's viewed. You know, the interesting thing for me was, for someone who's so anti-torture, okay, and I didn't have a very hard time torturing one of my characters, Maurice, okay, or Josh in Cambodia, okay, because yes, I feel very strongly about torture, against torture, yet all my life since the age 14, 15, my main passion in life has been children, and that includes crime against children. I have worked with so many orphanages. I worked with juvenile courts, and I represented sexually abused children. And I have really strong feelings about the child predators, okay? You know, the ones who are pedophile, and they commit so much crimes, and some of them, you know, targeting children as young as 2-3 years old girls, okay? I represented this child. When I lived in, this is long before I joined the FBI, but one midnight around 12:31, I'm sleeping, and the foster parents called me. They were in hospital because the child had fever, and they wanted me to go there because something horrible had been exposed as they were treating the kid. And I went there, and they found that the child had been raped repeatedly in the past, and the child had gonorrhea, okay? I mean, you're looking at a three and a half year old child, okay? So really having strong feelings about that too. And then there come some scenes that maybe subconsciously that translates into the sentences I'm giving as much as pain and atrocity to perpetrators of this, you know, these types of heinous crimes, okay? Now, how could you that, you know, be that, you know? Maybe some people are so achieved and good, you know, with goodness that they can be Gandhi-esque, you know? They can say that happened, but, you know, two wrongs don't make it right, etc. But I am not one of those people, okay? And the chance I got here allowed me to maybe channel some of the maybe hatred or the passion I have towards, you know, the perpetrators against children. So, but the book is filled with that, whether it is the, you know, that there are a lot of spying going on, they're monitoring of Congress, and then people who are monitoring people who are monitoring and spying on Congress, as you know, in the book. But their issue, the morality, the end justifies the means questions is a repeated theme in this book, because it has been the repeated theme in everything we are dealing with today, you know, especially with this case of what Elsie has been doing. And she has believed that it's justified. And we won't get into that. by taking revenge of all the minorities killed in, you know, Turkey and by some people who are here in the US. And she's thinking she is applying her own way of justice, bringing them into justice. So therefore it's justified. And Greg uses this, countering her arguments, saying, well, you are doing it. And you say the end justifies, you know, the means. Well, this is what I'm doing and what makes it wrong. And who decides really what is right or wrong? And we even get to the question of God or even religion, which for me has always been a major theme in my life, that philosophical thought, you know, when the comparison is being made and she's saying, well, you're considering yourself God, says, well, if you believe in God and you see all the horrific things that happen to people who never deserved it, you say, well, that is supposed to be part of the whole big scheme. And you cannot look at these individual cases. You know, that's the case with all the religions, how it's justified that no. You can't say why these children are suffering with cancer at the age 8 months. You know, if there is God, why are they suffering? Well, same thing. What about these people who are doing that and they're saying, well, we killed 2 million innocent people because we need to look at the bigger picture of what our objectives are or what we believe is the good thing that needs to happen. So what I'm trying to say is there are a lot of philosophical thoughts that have been weaved into the fictional scenes and characters and dialogues that are so part of my life. And it has been part of what all of us, the activists, the irate minority, have been doing.
Well, it is extremely interesting to think about, and to think about how outraged we can be at individual acts of violence, but then we can watch a Madeleine Albright on 60 Minutes saying, yes, 500,000 Iraqi children had to be starved to death, and I think it was a good thing, and most people are not outraged to the point of mania by a statement like that, although one would think they should be. So it is interesting to think about those issues, and I think, again, it was compellingly written in this book because the scenes, the torture scenes, are certainly described in vivid enough detail to make them uncomfortable. And yet, I didn't get the impression that this was, in some way, putting a stamp of approval on it. I think that that uncomfortable nature of it was very much left there and was cogitated on. So I wouldn't fault the book at all for that. However, it did seem that Greg was able to extract some successful confessions using torture, which might be, I suppose, controversial for the people who say, well, you could get any person to confess to anything under torture, basically. So it raises the question of whether torture is an effective tactic, which it seems to be in this book.
Isn't that the question? It is the question, isn't it? Because I have been struggling with that as well. Now, in this particular case, Greg knew all the answers. He wanted answers on record, and that was for his later use. And that was to put it out there when the time was right, to expose this, you know, the terror operation that was that took place in the country in 2001, the Great Terror in 2001. I never thought like 9/11, but you know, it's there, you know, the terror attack that took place, and it was doing that and putting it in there. Then again, we have someone who is witnessing, not watching it, but can hear and through her imagination know what is happening. And she's sitting there and she has a pretty, I would say, compared to Greg, a more linear a moral philosophy. And she doesn't do anything to stop it. Okay. And she's revolted. Yes. But on the other hand, you know, she's looking and thinking, I mean, in her own mind, of this horrific event that took place and the people or some of the people who were responsible for that. And again, it brings us full circle to exactly what we just talked about. And that is, what do you do to those people who are committing all these atrocities? Okay. Do you say, okay, let's, you know, have a trial and put you in jail and have you rot there? You know, do we just take them out? Do we forgive them and say, okay, hopefully you will become a better person. Don't do it again. It goes to those questions But you see, there were some clear lines that were not up to any interpretation, because we knew in this book and we know that it was a horrifying event that took place by these people. Now, if you compare that to people, tens of thousands of people in the last 14 years who have been rounded up based on some bogus tip from someone or based on what they were wearing, and they have been taken to places in Poland, you know, in some black sites, or they have been taken to Guantanamo, or they have just been tortured and then killed. So we never find out where they really ended up in before they were killed. And to say, what was the purpose in that? I mean, nobody was really looking for some specific confession on some event, okay? What was the... So there was not even that kind of presence of that kind of semi-even justification, saying, well, those interrogators for the government, you know, the CIA agents and everything, they had this objective while they were torturing it. A lot of it is so senseless when you're looking at what has happened. Even you're looking at some of the teenagers that were captured and taken, like the youngest one that was captured and taken to Guantanamo. So you look at that and then compare it to these, I think hopefully that would provoke some heavy-duty thinking from some people, hopefully, because a lot of people by choice, they don't read nonfictions about these issues. It's too bothersome. It bothers them, you know? On the other hand, when it's put in fiction, they can distance themselves saying, well, at the end, I can say, well, it's a fiction. But that doesn't mean that they don't go through some level of thought process or internal questioning as they are reading it. And that was my main goal in writing this, to attempt invoke that kind of response from people who are not watching our channels. You know, this is not for, you know, only Boiling Frogs Post and Corbett Report regular listeners, but the people who say, ah, I'm going to go to the airport, I will just go through it and read it on the plane. And because it's fiction, they may give it a better chance, more chance to sink in a little bit than they would by boycotting and never touching, never buying that particular book or a DVD or downloading it for free, because it is too hard for them to stomach. It goes against either their nationalism or it makes their life harder. I rather not know about it. That has been the biggest disease we've been fighting. People who don't want to know about it. Mm. I mean, even if it's before their eyes, they just don't want to know about it. And they are adamant about it, that they don't want to know about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's interesting to contemplate, too, because I certainly hope the Corbett Report listeners do read this book. I really do think it's worth their time. But it is interesting to think, because obviously this is, I think, perfect for those people who just at the airport need something to read on a plane kind of people who might not ever watch a video like this or read a nonfiction. So I think it is important in that manner. But it makes me wonder. I wonder how someone who knows nothing about you and your history and what you've been through in real life would think about this book. And I wonder if you've received any feedback along those lines or seen anything.
Yes, and I was really looking forward to that. Meaning, yeah, as you said, there are people who are purchasing this book. They're getting this book because they have read my other book. They know about my case. What I was really excited about or nervous about had to do with, how about people who are just going to read it as fiction? Okay, this is a fiction book. I don't know anything about Sibel Edmonds or being the classified woman, etc. I'm just reading a fiction. And I did hand out to more than a dozen of people. And the reaction was really good. I was really pleased. I was really pleased with the reaction. One of the things that was good for me to know was that, again, for some reason, people are characterizing this as a man's book, but I had some women who are not into politics or anything read it, and they interpreted it differently. They had their own fresh perspective, and they related more to Elsie and to the character Elsie, which is, you know, to be expected. But they didn't have that negative reaction of saying, oh, you know, I usually don't read, let's say, Clancy or Grisham. That's what my husband or my brother or whatever reads. So that was pretty good. And people who read it as just standalone fiction without any kind of previous books or case history knowledge, etc., the reaction was good. Some people were appalled that I could sit down and write things like that. I know one person was honest and said, wow, that brought the real psycho in you out with some of the scenes there, you know, because they thought it was highly graphic. But generally speaking, the reaction has been positive. And the fact that people have found it not difficult to read, because some books, for some reason, they tend to be tedious to read. You know, for example, I tend to read the books that have a lot of flashbacks much slower, because I usually like go back to the first page. What was that? Or who was this character? And because I had a bunch of foreign names in this book, I was really concerned about, you know, some Arabic sounding names, some Turkish names. And I eliminated some of them when I shortened the book from that 600, 700 pages. But I was glad, I was really pleased to see that people could follow. People could follow the story, and they didn't become really dizzy or saying, well, I mean, I really got that a lot from people saying, oh, I finished that in less than a day. I opened it and I couldn't, because I wanted to know what was going to come next. And then, you know, the... And then, of course, I had some people who are talking about Ryan Marcello, and it's like, man, he's such a hung. I hope you will bring him back in the next book. Look, some people got Ryan Marcello out of it. I don't know how, but some people got Ryan Marcello. But that's the thing about a book. You know, as I said, you can give even Orwell's book, 1984, to 100 people, and you won't get the same response. And I like that. I think that's exciting. This is why I love reading people's review, their reaction. I don't care if it's negative or positive. I like to find out how each individual person, you know, relates to it, or what is their take, or why they hated it, or why they loved it, what they loved about it. So I'm a big follower of anytime anybody writing a single review or comment, I like to go and read, because they're really important to me. Those are the real honest reviews, as I said, not the canned stuff they put in New York Times or Washington Post, but the readers. I want to hear back from the readers.
Excellent. Well, as I say again, if people are incredulous, I suggest they do go and look at some of that feedback on Amazon and other places. It is nearly unanimous that people are saying it is a page turner. And for a first-time writer, I mean, that is a good sign, and certainly a sign that you should be doing this again. And I hope you will be. Is there a series of books in the works?
Here's the pact I made with myself and a little bit even with my husband. And then I said, you know, it depends on the success of this book. I mean, if I get a lot of reactions saying, you know, this was so awful, I don't want to torture people. I'm putting more out there. First of all, it would be a waste of time for everyone. But if this is considered not from the main publisher's scale of success, but in terms of the reaction and how it does, absolutely. In fact, I already have the bullet points and even some of the scenes for the next book, as I was doing this first book, put aside and ready for, and I will determine that in the next couple of months. This book made me travel a lot. I did travel. Travel is something I really love, and travel is something that, I'm not saying for luxury reason, vacation. It's really important for me, especially now that we live in a very small city, 100,000, less than 100,000 population. There's not much diversity here. And because of my own background, it's so important for me as to take my daughter every opportunity I get, you know, however difficult it is financially to make it happen. I will cut back from other things, but I won't cut back from that. And take her to different countries, different cultures. You know, she's 6 years old, and she's already been to Cyprus and India and South Korea and Vietnam and Cambodia and New Zealand. I mean, she has been And every place she goes, we don't go and stay in westernized hotels and, you know, go eat, make the, we like to immerse ourselves into the culture as much as possible, as much as the culture allows us to be immersed in their, within their territory. And we like to combine it with other kind of activities. And while I was in Vietnam, I lived in Vietnam for almost a year. I got involved with some nonprofit organizations that were active in the human trafficking, and some of it involved child sex crime, etc., and worked within Southeast Asia, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. So with my daughter, I like to combine that with some sort of either 1 week or 2 weeks work where she is with the people, and we go to villages, or we are going to the people's house from that region, and she gets to be friends with their children. For the next book, it would require me to go to China, a couple of places in China. Here is the tip on the book. And right now, impossible. We don't have the finances, but that's at least one of the places that we have to go. And we have to go somewhere within the Eastern Europe. And that's going to be important. That's why I said it depends on the success of this book, both in terms of reaction. Was it liked? Was it received well? But also it has to do with, of course, the required financial backing to be able to travel and go stake out those places, get the feel, talk to people, and make it realistic. Because, I mean, nowadays I know it's easy. You can get Google, whatever, satellite map and see the places and get the description. It just doesn't do it for me. I when I'm writing and the scene is in Vietnam, or I even smell the scent of the markets and the streets there. I know how the alleys work. You know, when the scooter guy is giving a ride to the journalist and they're going from the backpacker district, I know exactly where that hotel is in the backpackers district. And I know where they board the boat that goes through the Mekong Delta, and you cross the border, water border in the river, and you get to Vietnam. And I know about these coffee houses where you go, and all of them have either one or two, you know, the internet connected PCs that you can work with. And I know how they talk English, and they're broken English. So when I'm writing about this, I'm feeling all the stuff that I have lived, I have smelled, I have tasted. And that translates into what I'm writing. I don't know. I can't just research, you know, go to the encyclopedia and read that and then write it. I've never had really much desire to go to Eastern Europe. That's one area I haven't traveled within, but the next book will make me go there. And to just again put a little hint in there, it's going to have some stuff to do with the real actual black sites in certain places. Not only the ones that have been known, but through my sources, the places that the people I know. So yes, I would love to be able to tackle and start writing the second book, including the travel that's going to be associated with it. And I'm still thinking about weaving Japan somehow into that, because my daughter is a big fan of yours. He is. I mean, she knows all my. She knows all my, you know, partners. But James, and she says James Kobe. So she loves. I mean, her favorite food is Japanese, because when we are eating out, we are usually eating ethnic food. It's either Japanese or Vietnamese or Thai. But Japan has been on my list for a long, long time, and she knows that you are there. So hopefully, we will be able to come to Japan as well. One of the places on my list, it happens to be, and it's been on my list, you know, I have this long list of places I would love to go and visit and experience, the very long, long list in my lifetime, during my lifetime. But one of them is the bamboo forest near Kyoto, which is about an hour or 45 minutes. And I've been obsessed with that bamboo forest since I was, I don't know, 23 or 24. I went to this photography exhibit and I saw that and I fell in love with it. But there it is, it's near you.
Yes, it is. We could drive there together. We would welcome you with open arms here, but I'm only afraid to see how Japan would fit into the narrative of a story like this and what it means. But absolutely. Well, this is a clarion call for action for those who do like this novel and do support your work. If you supported it monetarily by buying a book, excellent. You can also support it, of course, by letting other people know about this book and either using your copy as a loaner or encouraging other people to support the work as well. And, of course, supporting Boiling Frogs Post monetarily, donations, subscriptions. These are the things that are the lifeblood of this alternative media and that make things like this possible, including the research that goes into writing a book like this. As you say, it took 2 years of writing and then another 9 months of editing or however much. I mean, it's been years in the making, so this is not something that's just dashed off in a couple of weeks. And I hope people understand the amount of work and blood and sweat and tears that goes into this type of work. So Sibel, again, my hat's off to you for writing this and for the courage of putting this into words and going and exploring those dark territories that have to be explored when we're talking about these subjects. Of course, there's much more to say about this and how this nexus is into what's happening in the world today, but I think we'll leave this conversation here for today and we'll explore some of the ramifications of all of this more, hopefully, in future conversations. But Sibel Edmonds, thank you again so much for your time.
Many thanks, James.
This video is brought to you by the subscribers of BoilingFrogsPost.com. For more information on this and other topics, please go to BoilingFrogsPost.com. For more information and commentary from James Corbett, please go to CorbettReport.com.